UK Wine Show, show number 214. Ivan Donaldson from Pegasus Bay on Wipra. Hello, g'day, and welcome to the UK Wine Show for the 2nd of July 2010. My name's Chris Scott, and I hope this week's gone extra well for you guys. Shame about the World Cup, but on the bright side, it wasn't a penalty shootout against the Germans. Never mind, it's summer and everybody's now getting into the tennis and Wimbledon. As I said before, we're going to be talking with Ivan Donaldson from Pegasus Bay on Wipra. It's a wine region in North Canterbury, quite a small producer and one of the only few regions that actually increased production last year in New Zealand. But before we get into that, we're going to get our mystery producer. And as usual, I'm going to give you a clue now and a clue before the interview and then the answer at the end. Our mystery producer is a port house established in 1692 by Job Bearsley. They were also the first British firm to purchase vineyards in the Douro Valley. Quinta Vergalis is the main vineyard, which is situated high in the Douro Valley. In vintage years, the fruit from Quinta de Vergalis forms a backbone of the vintage wine. But in vintages that pass undeclared, the produce of this Quinta is bottled separately and sold as a single Quinta vintage port. I'm going to give you the second clue after the news, which is coming up next with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. Over 100 of the world's best wines have been awarded trophies by the International Wine Challenge this week. This is the final round for gold medal winning wines, where the wines are tasted alongside others in the same category. The trophy winners are recognised as the best in class and deemed to be of top quality. And the winners this year are France in first place for the second year running with 21 wines winning a trophy, followed by Japan's sake category with 14 trophies, and Australia in third place with 12, followed by Portugal with 11 trophies. For England, Camel Valley is the champion for 2010, winning the English trophy with its 2008 Pinot Noir Rosé Brew and taking the Sparkling Rosé trophy against international competition. For the full results, you can visit internationalwinechallenge.com.
I ran a tasting this week and we tasted Ridgeview versus Marley, which is a Grand Cru Champagne. And the people who tasted it, you know, a wee bit about wine. They couldn't work out which one was the champagne or not. So it's not surprising that English sparkling wines are now starting to win the top category in sparkling wines. Excellent stuff. What's the next story, Jane?
Well, new rules governing the labelling of Beaujolais wines have been released, ending a long-running dispute between Burgundy and Beaujolais appellations. Under the new rules, white Beaujolais may no longer be labelled AOC white Burgundy. That's one of the most contentious issues, and Beaujolais wines will be allowed to state the main grape on the label, provided they meet the percentage criteria for that varietal. A new appellation called Côte Bourguignon has also been created for red Beaujolais, replacing Bourgogne Grand Ordinaire.
More changes to the rules? What's the last story, Jane?
Finally this week, research has shown that brown glass filters almost 100% of damaging ultraviolet light compared to green glass at 92%. But what are the implications for wine? Well, brown glass gives better protection against short wavelength ultraviolet light, which can cause the release of sulphurous compounds within the wine, tainting it with what the French call goutte de lumière. And for Louis Roederer, brown is the new green. The Champagne House has switched its green champagne bottles for brown glass. First to appear in the new brown bottle is Roederer's Brew Premiere, and that'll be followed by the 2006 vintage. But the introduction of brown bottles is a costly move due to smaller production levels of brown glass, although cellar master Jean-Baptiste Lacayon described the decision as part of a strive for perfection. Orange is still in vogue for Roederer's Prestige Cuvée Cristal, which will continue to be bottled in clear glass and wrapped in the orange cellophane. The famous outer wrapping apparently achieves a 98% protection from ultraviolet penetration. That's all for this week, but don't forget to visit our website at 3050.co.uk.
Thanks, Jane. If brown was used for glass, then brown is actually quite helpful because we use a lot of brown glass in the UK, which is produced en masse. So it gives a useful use for all that wine glass. It can also be used in green glass. Sadly, green glass can only be used for green glass, so it's not quite as useful as brown glass. Obviously, the best colour is clear glass, because the UK is a huge user of clear glass. We make lots of preserves and glass products. Now, you don't see many white wines or red wines in clear glass, but you do see quite a lot of rosé wines out there. So maybe when you're drinking rosé, keep an eye out for a clear glass. Make sure, obviously, that it's got a very recent vintage. You don't want anything too old if it's in clear glass because of the UV light. Right, next up we have our spotlight, and this month's spotlight is the result of our poll. And we asked the question, which glass size would you prefer to be served in a pub? And the answers were 250ml, 175ml, or 125ml glass. Now, 34% pumped for the 250ml, 58% went for the 175ml, so the big winner there, and 8% went for the small glass. 175ml is a great size. Whites won't get too warm while you're enjoying them. On really hot days, perhaps a smaller glass may be the ticket, but I then tend to drink faster anyway, so I think a small glass with a bottle and a chiller would be absolutely the superb one. For a red wine, though, I think 175ml wine and a 250ml glass is probably the ticket. Then you can give the glass a bit of a swirl, take a wee bit of time to get through it so it oxidizes a wee bit, and that would be what I'd prefer, 175ml and a 250ml glass. Sadly, not too many pubs offer that option. Now, one more thing before we get into the interview with Alan Donaldson. It's our mystery producer. Now, I'm going to give you the last set of clues for this. It's a pretty big giveaway, these ones. The current name is derived from subsequent partners in the firm, being Joseph Taylor, who joined in 1816, well over a century after the firm's inception, John Fladgate, who joined in 1837, and Morgan Yeatman, who joined in 1844. Those people should give it away for you. It's a port company. Have we think about that anyway? I'll give the answer after we speak with Ivan Donaldson from Pegasus Bay in Waipara. Let's have a listen to what he has to say. Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Ivan Donaldson from Pegasus Bay. How are you, Ivan?
I'm very well, thank you, Chris.
Excellent. We're going to be talking a wee bit about Pegasus Bay and Waipara as well, but tell me, how'd you get into wine?
Well, I got into wine as a medical student, final year medical student. My wife, Chris, gave me a book, Hugh Johnson's first book entitled Wine. We read it together, fell in love with the book, fell in love with her, married, decided as a medical student that I wanted to have a vineyard and winery, and it was a dream that we pursued from that time onwards.
What age were you then?
Probably 24.
And so, what time before you bought the land up here in Waipara?
Oh, well, I hate to think about that, but I was a medical student in 1966 at that time, and we bought the land here in, let me stop and think, 1985. But before that, I had started the first vineyard in Canterbury, because when I became interested in wine first, there were no vineyards in the South Island, and the South Island now produces over 75% of New Zealand's wine. It was thought that it was far too cold to grow grapes here.
So where was your first vineyard?
First vineyard was close to Christchurch in a little suburb called Hawswell. And it was a group of like-minded nutters, doctors, dentists and the like. And I was the winemaker for that because I'd had amateur winemaking experience.
Homebrew or?
yes, a little bit like that. We tried to be more scientific, but we were essentially amateur winemakers in that, at that stage.
Yep. And then you came out here in 86, you said?
Came out here in 85.
85.
Yes, and we planted our first vines here, 85 through right to the present, just gradually increased the size of the vineyard, really.
And we're in Waipara here, so that's just north of Christchurch in the South Island, about halfway up the South Island.
It is, yes. I mean, it's the same latitude here as it is at South France, Marseille, but the climate's not the same. You understand, and that's why people thought it was too cold to grow grapes here.
You were one of the first in Waipara, weren't you?
I wasn't the first, but we were amongst the very first people to come here to this area. Yeah. And we came here after having the experience back close to Christchurch. We believed that this was a superior region here, and that's why we moved up here.
I think most of the vineyards in Christchurch at the time were mainly south of Christchurch.
Yes, they were.
And I remember even in 91, I was doing winter pruning in South Canterbury, getting very cold.
Well, indeed. And the reason that Waipara has developed, particularly as a wine area, is that the prevailing wind in most of the east coast of New Zealand, where grapes are grown, but particularly in Canterbury, it's exposed to wind that comes off the Pacific in the summer, which cools the temperature of the land. And here in Waipara, Waipara is a valley. This is Waipara Valley. And on the east, we are protected from the Pacific breezes by this. In fact, we're protected from Pegasus Bay by this line of hills, limestone hills, which are very important. And on the western side of the valley, there are limestone hills as well. So that's very important.
A lot of people may not have heard of Waipara as a wine-producing region. Marlborough, Hawke's Bay for sure. Even Otago is getting a bit of traction these days. But Waipara is one of those regions that aren't commonly thought of as a wine-producing region. How big is Waipara?
Well, Waipara, in fact, the vineyard area in Waipara is almost the same as in the entire central Otago. Waipara is a much more compact area. But if you look at all the areas in central Otago which are spread out, that amounts to about 6% of the New Zealand vineyard, whereas in Waipara there's about 5% of New Zealand vineyard is planted. I agree with you, people haven't really been aware of Waipara to the same extent, but we've found probably in the last 3 to 5 years that has changed rapidly and there's been much more international interest in the wines of Waipara.
We just tasted a... Well, actually, first of all, you showed me around, which was quite nice, and the grapes are almost getting ready for harvest, which is good. And then we tasted some of your vinos, which were very interesting. What sort of grape varieties do you think are the standout ones down here?
Well, I think for us, we think that aromatics are vitally important, particularly Riesling. And I think that there's one thing that this area does, it produces Rieslings from dry through to really dessert Rieslings with everything else in between. And I think these are quite exceptional wines. They can age, they have structure, and they have beautiful citrusy and floral aromatics to the wines.
Well, so the floral parts I really notice is maybe a point of difference for, well, particularly compared to, say, the limey Australian ones. And
yes, Australian Rieslings are quite a different beast to New Zealand Rieslings. Yeah. They tend to be much more austere, flinty, without the same aromatics and texture that New Zealand Rieslings.
And more floral, I thought, than even Marlborough.
Yes, indeed. Chris, that's due to the fact that we have very cold nights, but very hot days. The warmest temperatures, the hottest temperatures in New Zealand are recorded here in Canterbury, and it's because of the Southern Alps, or Main Divide, as we locals call the Southern Alps. And those provide us with the very hot days, and our proximity to the sea provides us with the cold or cool nights. Yeah. And so that's diurnal variation is very important in preserving developing and preserving the aromatic.
It also lengthens your grow time, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Yes, we bud burst reasonably early here, but we harvest probably later than just about any other area in New Zealand. And its flavours take are slow to develop. If you grow grapes in a warm climate, you often end up with a high degree of alcohol ripeness before you actually get flavour development.
I didn't see any frost protection. Is that an issue here?
Oh, yes, frost is. In fact, everywhere from Auckland south, frost is very significant. And, yes, we frequently have to protect against frost.
What do you use, spraying? Or?
Yes, we have water. We use wind machines as well. All of those things. No, they're there.
Okay. Excellent. So let's get back to... You talked about the limestone hills on the sides. Are you on limestone or what's your soils?
No, we're not directly. We're on a series of north-facing terraces which gradually drop down towards a river. We are well above the Waipara River, but there is a series of terraces which gradually descend, and they are a glacial moraine, and that's the reason that we came here. It's very special soil. Which is stony, freely draining, but has a limestone influence nonetheless, because both the eastern and western sides of the valley are limestone hills, and so the floor of the valley also has a limestone influence, and all the water here, for example, has.
So it's quite hard water, is it?
It is very hard water, and it's very good, I think, for the other another two varieties that we grow, and that is Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, both Burgundian varieties, mm-hmm. and in that part of the world, of course, grown in soil that has got a high limestone content.
Okay, so we tried your Chardonnay,
yes.
Quite nice acidic backbone. To it, but nice barrel fermentation there, so it was quite pleasant wine. Pinots, in terms of style, seem to be quite different to both the Marlborough and Central Otago. They seem lighter to me, and bit more like maybe Martinborough, maybe. How would you describe your Pinot?
Well, I think when you say lighter, I don't think they're lighter as in soft. I think they have probably a backbone.
Less extracted, perhaps.
Yes, yes. They're not as upfront fruit driven as a lot of Central Otago Pinots are, for example. They have a more tannic backbone running through them, which helps them age really well. So they have more subdued initial fruit, but very ripe flavours and very ripe tannins going through the palate. I think Marlborough Pinots often are softer. In the finish, I think white Pinots tend to have a very structured form. They tend to be mouth-filling with a backbone of fine tannins, and fine as in ripe tannins, but plenty of tannin. And I would agree with you, they tend to be particularly more like Martinborough Pinots.
You were saying earlier you're actually one of the first places to plant up Pinot in New Zealand.
If you look at the history of New Zealand Pinot up until the early 80s was basically a clone called Bactobel. It was about the only clone available, and that was one that came from Switzerland, and it was often used for fermentation into sparkling wine. So the first Pinots, I think, of any modern-day substance came out of Canterbury, of which Waipara is the northern most sort of vineyard area, and they Pinots really made New Zealand sit up and take notice. They were well, they won multiple gold medals and were stunning wines, mm-hmm. and I think that got the area away to a very major start in terms of Pinot. I think other areas came in with more modern clones, and I think that places like Waipara have gradually replanted or planted additionally these other clones. So there's been a big change in Waipara Pinot Noirs, which have, I think has been great.
Thank you. You mentioned something as we were going through the vineyard that I hadn't really clocked before about the Mendoza clone for your mm-hmm. Chardonnays.
Yes.
And talking about the hen and chicken going on. I would have thought hen and chicken, you know, that's where you get big berries mm-hmm. and small berries, isn't necessarily a good thing, but you seem to think it was quite good. Why did you think that?
Oh, I think it's very positive. It's I think if you look at, I think it also applies, in fact, in Pinot Noir, if you look at the clones that have big, fat berries, they tend to produce inferior wine. And I think the reason is that when you have a variety that basically doesn't set as well as other varieties, that means the pollination isn't so good. When you have a clone like that, you have all these little berries as well, and the ratio of skin to juice is higher, and all the flavor content, aromatics and everything, is all in the skin. So you end up with a wine that tends to have more richness, more fullness, more flavor, which is a very positive thing.
Do you leave your Chardonnay in contact with the skins for a while?
Not for a long time. We in fact, do allow it to have a small amount of skin contact after it's come into the winery, and the bunches, before they're pressed, we do provide, they are broken for a short while, left for a short while before they're actually pressed.
And the other great variety we tried some of your Cabernet and Merlots, which we're okay. I'm not going to get too excited about it.
No, well, I think Merlot Cabernet isn't our, it's not our focus here. Yep. Our focus, although I have to say we've had some very good press with Merlot Cabernet, but it's not our focus here. Our focus is Pinot Noir and white varieties, Riesling in particular, Chardonnay, and also I think Sauvignon Blanc blended with Semillon. We're one of the few vineyards in New Zealand to use that traditional blend of Sauvignon, the traditional French blend of Sauvignon Blanc with Semillon. Very few vineyards do that.
I remember coming through here, oh, it must have been about 8 years ago, and I popped in and tasted it, and I was really impressed with the Sauvignon and Semillon blend. It's one of those wines that have just stayed with me.
Well, very interesting, but it has been awarded 95 points out of 100 in Robert Parker's Wine Advocate, and it's the highest score ever given to a New World Sauvignon Blanc-based wine.
Yeah, I don't think he likes New Zealand Savvy, though. So.
He liked this one. He liked that. He liked that one. Yes, yes. No, that was really a really high score.
Yeah.
Yes, I think it's having said that, I think adding that Semillon, from our perspective, it helps the wine age. I think New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc is not a wine that you put away to age. You drink it within a year or 18 months. I think that Sauvignon, our Sauvignon Semillon, you can happily cellar for 6 to 10 years, and it improves, becomes more complex, mouth-filling, rich, not just a hit of upfront fruit.
Yeah. I noticed when I tried it, actually, it had a slightly struck match, slightly reductive note on the nose.
Yes.
Certainly not a problem, and adds a bit of complexity to the wine.
For us, it's not a problem. In fact, we'd be very disappointed if it didn't have it. We strive very hard to get that particular character in the wine, and we would hope to have that also in our Chardonnay.
I didn't see it in the Chardonnay.
You didn't see it. Well, lots of people do.
Yeah. Maybe my palate is faulty.
And we really try hard to get those characters. We don't try and get them in the Riesling, because Riesling for us is a pure expression of the fruit and the vineyard.
Okay. And what are your big export markets?
Well, we export to probably, at the last count, probably about 30 different countries.
Mm-hmm.
From our perspective, the biggest markets have been Australia, US, and parts of mainland Europe.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Belgium has been a big market. And I think increasingly the UK. We have not traditionally... the UK hasn't been one of our main export markets, unlike a lot of New Zealand wineries where that has been the case, but I think it's increasingly over the last few years has become important to us.
And who are your agents, just if anybody's after
yes.
you?
Yes, well, we have New Generation Wines,
mm-hmm.
and they're our principal agents, and we also sell through Margaret Harvey, Fine Wines of New Zealand. I think that from our perspective, it's been very interesting to see this whole area grow. We've been here right from the start, and it's now become a very significant part of the New Zealand wine scene. And we think its strengths lie in its very special climate, unique soils, and the mix of varieties that are grown here.
Excellent. All right, then, Ivan, I think we'll wrap it up there.
Okay.
Thank you very much for your time.
Okay, Chris.
Hope you enjoyed that interview. Nice bloke, really nice people down there making some very good wines. And as I said in the interview, I really like this Semillon Sauvignon Blanc. It's got a really lovely flavour to it. One question I didn't ask is how he works really hard to get that minerality or that reductive flint note in the wine. Obviously, it's in the winery, but I was wondering if he'd done anything in the vineyard as well. Never mind. I'll hopefully ask that next time I see him. Next week, we're going to be talking with Paul Fenner from Waiter's Friend. They are the leading, if not the leading, supplier of equipment and accessories to both the trade and people. So we'll talk to him about Waiter's Friend and all the different products they have. He's got an Aladdin's cave of equipment in his place. Now, the mystery producer, hopefully the people gave it away at the end. It was, of course, Taylor's, or as some people correctly should have spotted them, was Taylor's, Fladgate and Yeatman. That's their official title. Right, last thing to do is to have our mystery quote. And, of course, the mystery quote has to come from Pegasus Bay. While I was there, I went to the toilet, and on the wall is loads of different wine quotes. And this one caught my attention. It's certainly not true. But according to the toilet wall where they wrote these quotes, which I got this down from, Please be assured that all wine served on these premises has been sampled and passed by the management. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.